This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. This is the Kenai Conversation. I'm Sabine Pooks. It's been dumping snow on the peninsula and around South Central. If you're into skiing or snowboarding or snow machining, you've probably been dreaming about getting out into the mountains to enjoy it. But of course, with good snow does come some avalanche risk, and it's important for recreationists to know what they're getting into before they head out and up. Today, we're talking about avalanches with our guests. John Sykes is a forecaster with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. He has a master's in science from Montana State's Snow and Avalanche Laboratory and is working toward a PhD in avalanche research. He's zooming in with us from Anchorage. Hey, John, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Nick D'Alessio is a backcountry guide with his company Remarkable Adventures and a co-owner of Alaska Guide Collective. He has degrees in outdoor recreation leadership and outdoor studies and is an avid backcountry skier based out of Girdwood. Hey, Nick.
Hey, how you doing? Doing well here.
Good, good. And finally, Sean Sullivan is a snow machiner in Nikiski. He teaches avalanche classes for motorists through the Alaska Avalanche School. And he's currently at work, but will be here with us for as much of the hour as he can. Hey, Sully, how's it going?
Woo! Well, the guys over here think I'm doing pretty good. So happy to join for a few minutes. Hopefully I can take a few questions.
Absolutely. Thank you for that enthusiasm. I think we all needed that. That was great. So thank you all so much for being here. John, I'd like to start with you because the Avalanche Center just started putting out its daily forecast two or so weeks ago. So, and you're also newish to the center. So what is your job as a forecaster entail this time of year? How do you get these forecasts that the center puts out every day for recreationists?
Yeah, thanks, Sabine. So yeah, we started our forecast last weekend, and there's three forecasters at the Avalanche Center. So we kind of, essentially we just do a rotating forecast. So we'll do the day before, typically we go into the field, which lately has just been turning in past because there's not a lot of snow coverage in other areas, but yeah, so we'll go into the field and we'll either travel on skis or on sleds and collect as much information about the snowpack as we can. Oftentimes that entails just traveling around and seeing what the snow looks like and feels like. And we'll also pretty commonly dig snow pits and do kind of more formal stability tests to see what the snowpack is reacting like and kind of track how different layers are changing through time. And then we take that information, go into the office and combine it with other really crucial pieces of information, like public observations are a really big one. So if we get information from people who are traveling in other areas and maybe they see an avalanche or have some kind of interesting finding that they want to share with us, that can be super helpful. We also do a fair amount of weather forecasting to try and figure out what's going to happen the next day and extend what we saw the day before into the future. So yeah, and then in the morning we get up early, write the forecast, publish by 7 a.m. And then, you know, do some other little things, but that's the main gist of it.
Are you updating that information throughout the day based on what you're hearing from people who are actually out in the mountains?
No, typically the forecast gets published at 7 and then it's valid for 24 hours from then. So it's not very common that it'll be updated. Sometimes we'll update small things, like if we see a typo or something like that. But I don't think it's typically static from 7 a.m. one day to the next day when the next one comes out.
Gotcha. Nick, your work takes you into the mountains for guiding. When you're trying to figure out whether conditions are safe to take people out, where do you kind of begin? Where do you look for that information?
Well, I, like John, wake up pretty early and spend at least an hour or two looking on my computer and looking at, it's really a lot of it's weather information. First, I do like to look out the window. That's huge.
That's a great first step for anyone to take.
Yeah. Step on the deck, mm-hmm. Smell the air a little bit, look out the window, see what's going on. But then, yeah, it's really good. It's like a lot of computer work, actually, looking at what did the weather do over the last 24 hours? You know, what are the temperatures? How have they changed? what are the wind speeds? What direction is the wind coming from? Any new snow, you know, that all really affects the how John makes his forecast and those guys make their forecast. So I do rely a lot on the Avalanche Center as well. So like when I finish my own internal kind of forecasting, I'll then open up the Forest Service Avalanche Center website and see what they have to say. And then, but the thing is too, is I do a lot of trips also that are outside of the advisory area. Right. And a lot of these areas, you know, if I do a trip, like fly into the Alaska range, for a week long trip or something, there's minimal information. And so that's a whole nother approach to it. But on my daily stuff, I live in Girdwood. So I spend a lot of my days like in Turnagain Pass or other areas around the zone. And it's really a lot of computer work. And I would say that my decision on where I'm going is based off of what I'm seeing with the weather mainly.
Have you been out much yet this year yet?
I've been out a few times, yeah, personally. And then a couple times for work so far.
Gotcha.
Yeah. One thing about owning a business is I end up having to spend a lot of time in the office, which goes against my you know, personal ambitions, but it's the way I make my living, so it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Sully, have you started with classes yet for this year? You're an instructor at the Alaska Avalanche School. Can you talk a little bit about what that's like?
We haven't started any of our motorized courses yet, and I don't believe for the non-motorized user group either that they've begun any of their courses. But we do have several on the list, and if you want to go check those out, you can go to the Alaska Avalanche School website and take a look and see what's available there. There's still some openings for folks, and I certainly encourage that before you get out in the backcountry. If you're going to be recreating in avalanche terrain, it's a really good course. About $500, 2 days long, a little bit of online training, and then you get to go out in the field. And it's pretty much, we run it like the first day is almost like a guided tour with our instructors. And we are all pretty avid backcountry riders. And we take you on a trip from everything from the parking lot and what we cover in the parking lot with our beacon shovel probe, make sure all your gear is good, you know, checking each other out. You know, what did you see on the way to, when where we're riding, you know, because like Nick says that, the forecast doesn't always cover a lot of the riding area, you know, especially it's a point forecast for, you know, a specific zone. And if you're a skier, that works great a lot of times, you know, because you're skiing one specific zone. And so you can get a lot of information from that. As a snow machiner, you're covering several zones in short amount of times, and you're constantly stopping and checking snow conditions. And you could be going from a maritime condition to a continental condition in one travel period in Alaska, because it, you know, it's so vast here. And on a snow machine, you know, a tank of gas can go 120 miles. So, and that being said, the new snow machines that we get are what used to cost $25,000 to mod out yourself, and you had to be a mechanic to do it. Now, any skier or any new person that's, you know, coming into the sport, which we're seeing a lot of skiers picking up snow machines that haven't done much riding before, and these sleds will take you into any terrain that you want in a matter of minutes. And if you're not doing your homework at that moment and before you get there, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble pretty quick. And at the school, we're going to show you how to stay out of those things, a lot of those situations, how to recognize them ahead of time. And if you do get caught in one, what to do. And if someone else gets caught in one, we're going to make sure that you got that training to help that individual, whether it's someone you know or don't know or whatever, but to help you get them out of that situation. So first we want to make sure that you got the gear and everything that you need and you know how to use it. And then we're going to teach you about the forecast. So when these guys are putting out a great forecast, you'll be able to recognize what's going on there and say, oh, okay, this means this, that means that, all those things, right? This picture, you know, square peg, square hole, right? So, and then out in the field, we'll be teaching you all that point stuff, you know, okay, we're here, we're going to stop here, we're going to look at this. You know, we all know, I guess we don't all know on this radio show, but the three of you guys here do, you know, what does it take to actually create an avalanche, right? Am I in avalanche terrain? Okay, so what do we need? It's really simple for the folks listening. Okay, we need some snow, right? Because if you don't have any snow, you're not going to have an avalanche. I need a slope that's steep enough for this snow to slide on. Okay, so when I'm looking at a slope, Is it steep enough for that snow to slide on? Anything over, you figure 18 degrees, you're going to be taking a second look at maybe and talking about. All right. Now I'm going to need a weak layer for the snow to slide on because it's got to slide. Okay. If it's like in Seward, the snow is just pasted on. That's why there's not a lot of avalanches recorded down there. We don't have too many problems. That hazard still exists. Don't get me wrong, but the snow conditions don't create typical hazard, you know, avalanche hazard conditions down there that we see at Turnagain Pass, for instance, like that exists now. There's great hazard that is existing now, and these guys will be able to talk about it later on the show. Yeah, so we'll be running you through that while you're out there, the things to look for, stay out of trouble. And then on the second day, it's really cool, is that the class leads it, right? So from the morning in the parking lot, it's up to you guys. And, you know, as we go throughout the day and we practice our beacon shovel probe and our rescue, you know, we're going to go practice a lot of rescue. We're going to, you know, maybe dig a snow pit and show you a little bit of snow science stuff. Yeah, it's a good course. And on the second day, we want to make sure that everybody is capable of rescuing somebody, staying out of trouble, recognizing trouble, getting back to what it takes to create an avalanche. You got to have snow. You got to have a slope for it to slide on. You got to have a weak layer. And there's one more thing that you typically got to have, and that's a trigger. And that's what we're looking at with, you know, when we're talking about in our avalanche course, we are the trigger. Okay. It's a human triggered avalanches is what we're typically talking about. Now, there's non-human triggered avalanches too. And those can be, you know, sometimes mixed up if you see one across the valley, like maybe I set that off, but that's all it is. So if you can recognize that those things exist, you know, if there's a weak layer and a slope for the snow to slide on, I would not ride in those conditions. What's so great about being a snow machiner though, that skiers can't do, is I can go ride in less than 18 degree slopes and have super fun and pow all day while my skier buddies on the other side of the highway, Turnagain Pass, got to hang their head and kick rocks and go back to their car in the parking lot and then sit there and contemplate if they can afford the monthly payment on a new Skidoo or a new Polaris so they can go to the other side of the highway and go play with all their other buddies that are having fun. So, wow.
Nick, I feel like I have to give you a chance to respond to that.
No. Oh, yeah. No, that's all good. I don't agree with Sully. I mean, on a snow machine, you know, 0 degree slope and getting face shots all day, it's pretty, and it's like a lot of fun, you know?
Well, and it was interesting what you were saying, Sully, about how when you're traversing so much terrain and kind of that those different strata and different climactic kind of areas, you really have to think about a lot of different factors. You're not just in kind of one spot. You're really going over a litany of different conditions, and that kind of necessitates maybe a deeper sort of understanding of the specific area you're kind of in.
It's like most things in life, it's a lot easier if we communicate, you know. So I've been married for 15 years and that marriage works pretty well because I've learned to communicate with my wife pretty good about stuff. So when you're out there in the backcountry, you need to communicate with your partners about everything you see, because the knowledge is back and forth and it's changing all over, you know, and every little bit of information is going to count towards a successful day in the backcountry and coming back with smiles instead of other bad stuff happening. So on top of those things that it takes to create an avalanche, just one more little tidbit of information that, you know, if the snow is the problem, right, we have avalanche conditions are out there. We know that they exist for one reason or another. Maybe we saw a recent avalanche, or we saw conditions in the snow that we don't like, that we know are inherent of avalanche conditions. Terrain is the answer, right? So we just mellow out our terrain. Okay. If you don't like the snow is, change where you're going to go ride, change where you're going to go ski, put on your cross country skis, go walk the dog, whatever it's going to be, but it's okay to turn around. All right. Never commit yourself to a situation that you can't come back from. All right. When I'm at the precipice and I'm about to drop in on something that's really big, trust me, I've done my homework that I'm accepting that risk. And we all have just different risk acceptance. Okay. I'm not here to tell you what you can or can't do or shouldn't do. That's up to you. That's what's so great about this God-given world that we live in. Right. I have the right to choose my own path. If I want to do my homework, I will. And if I don't and go jump it off, I'm allowed to take that risk. So all I'm saying is, you know, up your chances by getting a little more knowledge before you go take the risk, right?
Absolutely. And that's a good plug for, yeah, taking an avalanche course. I actually just signed up for an avalanche course myself. I'm a skier, so I'm very excited about that. And I do want to talk more about conditions that kind of precipitate avalanches in a little bit. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about, or Nick, were you raising your hand?
Yeah, I guess I, to follow up with Sully, I, sure. So I teach avalanche courses all for backcountry skiing primarily, right? Human powered. I think I would just like to reiterate that for snow machiners, it is definitely worthwhile to take the actual specific snow machine course, because like the terrain, you know, the mountains, the terrain, the weather, the snow is all the same. Like we're all speaking the same language and it's all the same, right? I mean, the mountains don't care if you're on skis or snowshoes or snow machine, but what is different is the way you travel and the way you communicate. And so if I think there's a high value in a specific snow machine course.
Right. And the courses that you can take, yeah, they're different courses for different types of recreation, which is really cool. John, I'd like to kind of come back to the Avalanche Information Center, because my understanding is that the center was actually kind of born out of tragedy. Can you talk a little bit about how and why it got started back, I believe it was the late 90s?
Yeah, so the kind of push to start up the Avalanche Center came from a really big accident that happened. I think it was in late March of 1999. And it was, turning in pass, there's the one side of the road, the Seattle Ridge Road, which is on the west side. That's the snow machine, like the motorized area. And on the east side of the road is the skier area. And it's kind of divided that way just to minimize user conflicts. But anyway, there was a really big avalanche on the motorized side, right next to the common up track that people use to access the ridge where there's more terrain. So it's a little bit of a pinch point where just to get from the parking lot up to the rest of the train, you have to travel through this corridor. And there's an avalanche that I think involved like a dozen people. Six people were killed, unfortunately, and several more were buried but recovered or only partially buried. So it was a big eye opener, I think, for the community and as far as being able to get funding to start an avalanche center and start putting out consistent information so that we can give people the information that they need to make good decisions in the backcountry. They're not just kind of showing up blind. So, yeah, and it kind of started off more as a sharing weather observations and sharing observations from the field. And over time, it's morphed into a forecasting product where we're actually, you know, putting what we call a danger rating for the day. So it could be either low, moderate, considerable, high, or extreme. It's a 5-level scale. And we put out this rating to kind of let people know, where are we in the grand scheme of what avalanche conditions can be, and give some suggestions on where you might find avalanches, what kind of terrain you can safely travel in for the day, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
I know that your kind of academic background and your current academic focus in your PhD program is on snow science, which is not something I knew you could study in school and is very cool. because that I think is such an interesting kind of field of study, can you talk a little bit about maybe how you use that science in your day-to-day at the center, if you do?
Yeah, so it's a very small field. That may be why you didn't realize you can study
it. It's a little niche.
Yeah, so there's kind of a couple different ways to approach it as well. So several research programs will approach it from more of an engineering standpoint, like how much strength does it take for different types of weak layer to fail, and understanding like the crystal structures of the individual grains of snow. It's like really can be really fine scale in that way. The stuff that I'm doing currently is more about how to enable recreationists to make good decisions in the backcountry. And we're trying to do that by providing kind of two things. One is some a little more nuanced maps. So maps that will relay like where avalanche start zones are located and how far runouts can happen from on different slopes. So you have something a little bit more specific to the avalanche hazard than just like a regular topo map. So that's one thing. And then the other part of my current research is to use those maps and that kind of spatial data to come up with decision-making tools and help people really simplify the decision-making process, because it can get pretty complicated. Like, I think one of the points of avalanche education is to distill and simplify things. But a lot of times when we're out there, you're traveling in this kind of gray area where the conditions are, they're not super bad, but they're not super good either. They're kind of somewhere in the middle and you're trying to figure out what is my risk tolerance and what slope should I travel on today? So kind of trying to develop some data-driven tools that can help people make that call and interpret the terrain in a consistent way.
Yeah, that seems like an interesting sort of interplay between wanting to simplify things so people understand it, but not wanting to zap the nuance right out of it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think if you oversimplify, you can get in the situation where the things that you've learned don't necessarily apply to the conditions that you find yourself in. And I know that as I was going through my avalanche education, it's a little counterintuitive, but it's almost like the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't really know that much and that it's actually kind of complicated and there's a lot of nuance to it. And I don't know, maybe Nick has had a similar experience through his track of his career, but it certainly can be humbling. And it's, so anyway, back to your point, it's good to kind of keep it simple, but at the same time, address the complexity by trying to capture different conditions and how we can manage terrain under different kinds of conditions.
You both have also recreated outside. I know you both kind of have experience in the lower 48 as well. Are there a lot of conditions and considerations that are specific to Alaska that we're thinking about? Like, I know there are avalanche centers kind of in other parts of the country as well, but do people think about recreating here differently in a way that necessitates a different kind of practice? I'm curious about how Alaska maybe compares on that front.
I can maybe chime in on like the forecasting front. So one of the big differences here is that we have a massive amount of mountainous terrain and like very few avalanche forecast centers. So like Nick was talking about earlier, if he's going to do a guided trip into the Alaska range, he essentially has to create his own forecast and get his own information from the field. And in a lot of locations, there basically is no information available. So that really adds a level of complexity and challenge to it that I think is pretty unique to Alaska. There's certainly areas in the lower 48 that are similar. You know, you have forecast centers with defined boundaries, and then there's other mountainous areas that you can recreate in that don't have forecasts. But the sparse information that we have up here is really hard to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah. Nick, do you have anything to add? I know you're from the East Coast originally.
Yeah. Born and raised in New Hampshire. Been in Alaska for like 14 years now though, but I've been lucky to ski in, you know, Canada, some hot spots in the low 48, South America, New Zealand. And yeah, it is different. And I think a lot of it comes down to your resources. Like John's talking about, it's like, what kind of resources do you have or not have? And even the ones that you have, they're different. Like in Alaska, one around this area, we're actually really lucky to have access to the public has access to all the weather stations, which is amazing. In like New Zealand, I mean, you have to pay for that access, right? And so you don't, unless you're like an operation that needs that information, you're probably not going to get it. And yeah, it is different. I mean, like Colorado, I mean, just about every sub mountain range has its own specific forecast. Here we've got mountains for lifetimes. And you've got a forecast center that you look at a map of Alaska is about a pin dot. You know, that's all we got. It's a very valuable resource, but
cool. Right.
There's massive mountains everywhere for a lifetime that have no weather stations. Weather forecasts are you know, potentially questionable just because of the remote nature of them. You got hardly anyone traveling in there for observations. And so it is this whole super remote setting where your uncertainty levels have to be a lot higher.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned kind of access and accessibility, and Sully's chimed off for a moment, but he before was mentioning, you know, the cost of avalanche classes, and, you know, avalanche gear is expensive and there's a lot that needs to be purchased. Trust me, I've looked into it. What are kind of some of the ways that people who are not, who, you know, don't have a lot of money to kind of spend on this sort of thing, how can they make sure they're safe without breaking the bank? What are kind of some ways to get around that kind of high cost of entry that maybe you guys have seen? It's just an, it's an expensive hobby, skiing, or it's all very expensive, but in particular, some of this avalanche gear I know can kind of rack up into the hundreds or,
Oh yeah. Fun is not cheap.
No.
That's for sure. I would say that if there's one thing to buy new and modern is your avalanche beacon. Absolutely. I mean, personally, I buy a brand new one every 5 years. Industry standard is, a beacon that is 10 years old is like absolute max lifespan. I mean, these are computer devices. I don't know anyone's cell phone that lasts, 10 years.
For people who don't know, what is an avalanche beacon?
So it's, we call them avalanche beacons or maybe a transceiver. Basically, it's this similar to almost really a radio device where you've turn it on and you're transmitting a signal that sends out this electromagnetic field, kind of like a radio station that we're all listening to right now. Doesn't go quite as far, but yeah. And then, so you wear that all day. And then let's say you were to be caught in an avalanche and buried, your partners would take their beacon out and then flip it to the search mode. And then that can receive that signal. And then, they're quite simple, yet they also require a lot of practice to be proficient with them. And with the beacon in the search mode, you'll be able to work your way towards the buried person and then figure out basically right where they are underneath the snow. And then from there, you take your probe to actually physically strike them to know like, okay, that is a person there and they're about, yay deep. And then from there, you're going to be getting out your shovels and dig like you've never dug before.
Wow. And so how much do those beacons tend to cost?
Oh, what are they, John, these days? So many numbers in my head. at least over 300 to 500 or 600, I guess. And I mean, the model I have is the higher priced one, but it's got all fancy settings. You can adjust and everything. Regular recreational skiers don't need that. So the simpler, basic ones are probably just fine for everybody. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think you can even get them for like between $200 and $300. And I agree, they sell ones with additional features that are good for professionals who are going to practice with them a lot. But for somebody who's a recreationist and just needs to be, using it and practicing with it maybe once a year or a couple times a year, like a basic level digital beacon, ideally with three antennas, is kind of an important part. It helps it be more accurate in the searching phase. It's around $250 for that. So it's definitely an investment. But I agree with Nick. It's not necessarily a place where you want to skimp. If you're going to save money, get used skis and used skins and poles. But on the beacon, definitely I would recommend a new one as well.
Well, luckily Christmas time's coming, so and you can also rent gear, right? In some places, and I'm not sure about on the peninsula, but I know there's places to rent in Anchorage at the very least. Do you guys recommend renting some of that gear if you're not planning on getting out maybe as much?
Yeah, totally. I think one place that I'm familiar with that rents it is Alaska Mountaineering and Hiking in Anchorage. They rent touring setups and skins. And I think that'd be a great way to do it. Get yourself out there, see if you like it. If you're a skier and you're just interested in trying backcountry skiing, it's a great way to try out the setup and get a little bit of experience. If you're totally new, it's also a great way just to see if you like it at all, you know, because it is, you don't want to spend $1,500 buying everything and then realize that you're not going to use it that much. So it's certainly an investment. I will say, you're kind of asking about some things that were ways to kind of get lower cost introduction. And there are some good online tools that you can get for Avalanche education. There's a website called Know Before You Go that gives some really nice like video-based introductions to Avalanche terrain and kind of the fundamentals. And there's also a website called avalanche.org, which is a national website. And they have all the forecast centers in the US are hosted there. So you can see what the current avalanche danger is everywhere. And they also have a bunch of resources about tutorials of how things work. So it's a good place to start. I would still definitely recommend taking a organized avalanche class like you're signed up for. But yeah, just to kind of get your toes wet and see what it's like, it's a good place to start with some free online tools.
Yeah, and I would add to that, it is definitely very expensive. I spend way too much money on gear every year. But, some people might view an avalanche course as an additional cost, but really it's probably one of the cheapest things you can do. And the good thing about the avalanche education is that it's something that does not depreciate, right? The value actually continues to grow through the years as you gain your experience. And so you can spend your $500 or whatever it is to take the course. And then from there, that $500 just like grows, you know? And whereas like a pair of skis or a snow machine, I mean,
right,
they depreciate right their value.
And I actually have a friend who lives in Colorado who is thinking about coming up here to take a class because she said it's more affordable to take an avalanche class up here than the ones that she's looking at. So I don't know. Maybe
maybe I should raise my prices.
No, please don't do that.